Double-dee-deeble-dee. Well, I'm in a traffic hell. This is one of those where they've closed a lane, and then there's a stoplight up ahead where the timing wasn't changed. So there's no cross traffic, but it keeps changing. So I had to sit at a light and wait to turn right onto a road where there was basically no room to turn right. And some fuckface made his own lane to my right. I didn't even know he was there until he basically was going to just turn ahead of me. And I was like, you're very lucky that I didn't just like hit you in my blind spot. Because you're not only are you in my blind spot, but you're not really on the road either. Very annoying. And, like, everybody's honking, like, trying to be like, somebody should go. But it's like there is literally nowhere to go. I mean, there's no... The only way to do it would be to have... You know what? If you're not going to change the light, you need to have a guy fucking directing traffic there and alternating it. Because it just doesn't work. It's horrible. Everything's horrible about driving. I had a worse person on the flight. Now I can't remember who it was. On the way out, I had an entire row to myself for the first time. And it was fucking amazing. Like, you know what's shocking is how much more pleasant it is to fly when you're not jammed in next to people. I think I paid the price, though, because then on the way back, I was next to a very hefty young lady who did not fit within the armrests and stuff. Which I was like, I thought this was a thing where it was like you had to buy two seats or whatever. But then I was like, they probably do force people to buy two seats, but then they don't actually vacate the other seat. They're just like, fuck it. We'll just pay for it twice. I mean, here's what sucks about it. It's like, I don't want to punish someone just for being fat. That's not really my issue. I don't really care about it. But when I'm trapped on the plane... And it's like basically, and she's like falling asleep and her entire arm and shoulder and stuff are over the top of my body. I mean, we're sort of sit up spooning against my will. Let's put it this way. If I chose to sit like that and I didn't need to, wouldn't everyone be like, what the fuck is wrong with you? You know what I mean? Wouldn't that be totally wrong and weird and probably like press charges on me? But because it's somebody who can't help it, it's like, well, you just have to be the bigger person then, you know. You just have to sort of accept that that's what life is. That's what your life is, right? Because this person is this way. This is the next... You've doomed me to the next 3 hours of my life in a terrible, terrible day. So it's like, it was funny because, I was like, this is so great when I was flying out. I was just like, I can't believe this, and I can't believe this is happening. And the flight was so much easier to tolerate. Just having a little space. I think even if it was just, if the seats were just a little wider, and maybe not all connected to each other where it feels like, you know, person two rows up sneezes and, like, the whole thing's shaking around would be nice. But goddamn. I've never flown first class, but I've always sworn, like, hey, if I ever go abroad again, I want to fly first class. Even though I probably won't because it's so fucking expensive. But on the other hand, you're just like, man, I can see why, for example, you know, we're booking, if you're booking an author to come somewhere, why they might be like, I got to fly first class. You know what's interesting is one time we were booking this author who shall remain nameless. But because of this author's size, the travel requirements were higher. So, you know, you had to book first class tickets because this person's size was significantly larger. And you couldn't book like a compact car, you know, because this person's size was greater. And it was sort of like, boy, I don't want to not book this person because of their size, but I will say that there is a budget issue here in terms of size. I don't know. It's interesting. It's an interesting world out there. I mean, I guess it's just more expensive to be big, but, you know, here's the thing. Like, would I be more okay with, you know, I don't even know if, like, fat jeans are more expensive. But if fat jeans are more expensive, I would be fine with them dispersing the cost across, like, you know, all the sizes, right? Or, you know, if the cost was just basically for the raw material. So a big pair of jeans would probably just cost, like, 7 more cents, right? It's not going to be, like, $8 more out of 24. If you did it fair, if it was fair. But the thing is, somebody wearing, like, a big-ass pair of jeans doesn't really affect me. And, you know, if the cost is just spread across everybody, I'm not even going to know. You know what I mean? I buy jeans, like, once every 5 years. I'm not going to fucking know that, like, huh, I think I'm paying for some fat guy's extra stitching here. Like, I'll never know, so just do it that way. Or just, you know, be fair about it. Like, I bought, like, a jersey, right? And it has a huge embroidered patch on it. And I'm like, I guess it would be more costly with this kind of material to make something a lot larger. But it's not going to be way more costly. Like, it's not that the profit should also go up proportionally, right? It's like, let's take it easy. Let's just calm down. But on the airplane, it does affect other people. I mean, it sucks. It sucks. I don't know. I don't know what's to be done about it. I don't know what the answers are. I mean, I guess they could have, like, fat person seats, but then I would just want to sit in the fat person seat. I'd be like, well, I want to sit there. Like, just for the space. I'd like that. There's got to be a certain level of, like, fatness or tallness or whateverness that makes flying intolerable. I mean, I never feel like a big guy except when I'm on an airplane, when I feel like, curse my giant frame. You know, I'm a fairly small-framed gentleman, average size at best, and even I feel like it's too small, so I can only imagine that for larger people, it just must be awful. It must just be, like, intolerable. I don't know. An exercise in, like, claustrophobia, really. Because it's like, well, from the time I get on this plane till the time I get off, even if I get up, I can't stretch out all the way. I'd have to, like, lay down in the aisle, which I'm sure they wouldn't let you do. I thought it was funny, too, because, like, they make such a big deal of, you know, your carry-on thing, like, shove it under the seat in front of you, you know, and they're like, to keep the aisle clear for, in case of an emergency. And I'm like, I mean, it was not just the one lady, it was two. The aisle and the middle seat were these large ladies. And, I don't think I would have been able to get by. I mean, if what we're talking about is safety, I was like, I would just have to step on top of them. You know, on top of their charred corpses to escape. There's no fucking way that I would get out of there. I mean, it's like, what difference is it going to make? It's like, well, if only a Nintendo DS hadn't been on the floor at his feet, he would have escaped. And it's like, I have, like, a physical barrier from getting off at this point. I mean, give me a fucking break. Also, a little flying tip for everyone. This is like my, if I was the first gentleman etiquette type of things coming back again, rearing that ugly head. You get off the plane in the order that you're seated. So, you know, the first row goes, then the second, and so on. You don't just, like, the plane lands and you just line up in the aisle and go up as far as you can. Like, that's not how this works. It's just like, can we just be, like, orderly at one time? Can we, for one time in our lives, do things in an orderly fashion? I think the thing is, like, people don't understand, because it looks slow and deliberate, But I think that, like, time doing things in an orderly, clear fashion, it's almost always going to be faster to do it, you know, in a logical way than to do it in a, like, everyone's trying as hard as they can to get there as fast as they can. I got on a bus in Morocco where they do not believe in the concept of the line. Like, I gotta wonder, it was one of the bigger cultural shocks when I got there, because we were at the airport in, what's that fucking movie? Casablanca. And we had to change planes. And so we're, like, going through security, and so we got in what we thought was the line, but we didn't move anywhere for, like, 10 minutes, and kind of realized, like, I think we're just supposed to kind of shove our way to the front. That's what everyone else seems to be doing. And it turns out that's what you do. And so we're getting on this bus, and I'll never forget, like, this old woman is trying to get on the bus, and, you know, people are just, like, shoving and whatever. They're not, like, two-handed full-on shoving each other. They're just jockeying for position. It's like every line, even though we're getting on a bus that has enough seats, everybody's treating it like they're getting on an extremely crowded subway. You know, and they're just like, well, we all got to just mash in as much as we can. That's kind of what it was like, except unnecessary. Like, we're getting on an airplane. The seats are sold. They know how many people are getting. It's not like, you know, hey, the first 20 people who are on, go, and everybody else, fuck off. It was like, everybody's going. We're all going. So I got to believe, though, it would be total reverse culture shock if you came here from there. Because you would be like, you would see a line and just be like, walk up to the front and be like, what's the problem here? Like, what? Everyone seems to be very upset about the way that I've made my way to the service desk here. And I'm not really sure why. But then maybe not. I mean, okay, here's the thing. Here's why it's culture shock. That's like normal behavior. That's just how they do it there. And here, that's how assholes do it. So that's why it's such a bad, I think, culture shock kind of thing, right? Because you would be acting like an asshole in this country for something that's totally normal where you're from. So not only would you be doing something, like, wrong, but you'd be doing it in such a way that it's like, you know who else does that? Total dickheads. You and the total dickheads are the only ones who do it that way. Oh, I remembered, though. I'm not going to call this big lady the worst person on the flight. The reason being, it's not her fault. Also, an interesting thing happened. So I'm reading short stories of Flannery O'Connor, and I'm reading it on the Kindle Fire. So it's this big, bright screen, right? And I get to a story, and the title is The Artificial Narrative. Now, I got to that story on the last flight I was on, where I was like, you just like swipe the page and then you see it and you're like, whoa, you know, because it's in there. There are some like racial slurs in her stories and stuff because they're from the South, from a time when those words were used. However, none of them, you know, this is like 24 size font or something like that in huge black bold letters on this bright white background. It was just highly visible. And so I'd meant to read, you know, and like you're on this title of the story page. So you're like, well, I got a page worth of time where I'm just like broadcasting probably the worst word you can broadcast at any given time. How fast am I going to read this page? And so this came up on my last flight, and then I was like, oh, God. Because I would think anyone who saw that is probably going to be like, what the fuck is this guy reading? What the fuck? As one of my favorite characters from Die Hard with a Vengeance put it, when Bruce Willis is wearing a sign with a racial slur on it in, like, Harlem or some shit, and a guy sees him from down the street and says, what the fuck? that's what I would think the reaction to this would be as well. Maybe not yelled down the street, but certainly in the mind. I don't think it's, let's put it this way, I don't think it's going to endear me to my fellow passengers. I'm not at the level yet of the guy I sat next to who had the fully spread naked woman tattoo. Where I'm just like, I don't give a fuck. I'm like, I don't really care. Like, I'm not looking to make friends, but I'm not really looking to, I don't know, make people think that I'm like a fucking asshole either. Anyway, so that's like what I had to read on my Kindle, and I did not read it because I was like, you know, I'm just not going to bust it out. I'll just not read that for now. Because I just felt like, you know, sitting next to the woman I was sitting next to was black also. And, you know, and she was so far over in my zone that I was like, there's a lot of overlap here. And this turned out to be a great choice because I also had a comic with me, Earth X. And I started reading that and she's like, oh, what are you reading? And was asking me about it. And it turns out she's like into comic book movies and comic cons and stuff. But I was like, okay, well, good thing she wasn't like, because if she had asked me the same question when I was reading that story, I would have been like, oh, you know, some short stories I was assigned that, boy, these are really problematic, huh? Here's what I'm glad for. I'm glad that I discovered this and that I also remembered it miraculously. And therefore didn't just, like, swipe to that page, you know, unwittingly as I'm sitting next to this young lady on the plane. That would have been much worse than just, whatever. It's got to be weird, like, you're reading, I don't know, Huck Finn on a Kindle. You're on the plane, it's just like, N-word this, N-word that. You're like, oh my god. I would think, you know, someone looking over your shoulder or something might just be like, what the fuck are you thinking? Someone asked Chuck in a workshop because he talked about, you know, writing on the plane and stuff. And he's like, someone was like, do people ever look at what you're doing? And he's like, no, like, I've never actually caught anyone who seemed to be interested at all. And he's like, but if they did, that's when I immediately go into, like, disgusting shit and, like, child pornography and stuff like that. Just, you know, make them pay the price for their snoopery. I had two other pieces of listener mail that we didn't get to last time. One was an Instagram comment. Well, sort of. It was relayed to me through a mutual friend. And it was basically like, doesn't he know that he's, like, risking his life by taking this many flights? Like, how much riskier, how much higher his percent chance of dying is or something like that. Which, I mean, you know, there's the old saw of, like, flying is safer than driving. Which I've always countered with my old saw, which is like, yeah, but when I get in a car accident, I'm just going to be, like, going along at 80 miles an hour and then crash. When I am in a plane crash, it's going to be like 10 minutes of me pissing myself and screaming in terror while I'm upside down and knowing I'm going to die. I mean, that's the real problem with the plane crash, right? If it was instant, it wouldn't really be that big of a, I don't think it would have that much fear factor. If it was just like, well, you know, like the one, there was one where like the pilot did some weird shit and like everyone in the plane was passed out or something. I can't remember. He, like, depressurized the cabin and flew into a mountain or something like that. I mean, if that happened, you'd just be like, oh, fuck it. I mean, I didn't know. I was not aware of anything happening. So it's weird. Like, I've been getting used to flying a little bit in the turbulence and stuff. Because it's like, you know, I'll be on the plane and I'm like, I mean, the turbulence on the plane shouldn't be any more worrisome than, like, the rumbling in a car or on the train on the way. You know, I'm like, on the train on the way to the airport, I'm never concerned. And yet on the plane, I'm, like, terribly concerned. I'll give it to this, though, to those folks who are, like, afraid of flying. It does seem excessively high. It's like, how high are you going to go? I don't know, 30,000 feet. And you're like, 30,000 feet? Like, how come you couldn't be like, I don't know, 500? That seems pretty fucking tall. I mean, how tall is the tallest building in the world? A couple feet higher than that. I mean, like, we're flying over these mountains in Colorado. There's like 14,000 foot mountains, and they're like way, way below. And you're just like, all right, so do we need to do this mountain times three in height? I don't think that's necessary. I think you guys are just showing off. Like, look how high we could go. I guess I don't feel like it's terribly an unsafe activity. I mean, I guess here's the thing is, like, I've probably had fewer beers since I've been traveling more. I've spent less money. Somehow. I don't know how that worked out, but, like, doing this has been less expensive than my normal life. I've gotten my medical shit taken care of while I've been doing this. I could sleep more. That's definitely a need. But that's coming. And, you know, these are the things. The point here is, like, these are, and I've been exercising pretty well, too. Like, pretty regularly. And, like, the point is, these are the things that I think are going to get somebody more likely than a plane crash. I mean, it's like, I think it's more likely to meet your bitter end from, like, well, I haven't walked a mile in like 15 years. It's like, okay, well, that's probably not going to turn out well for you, as opposed to, like, I took 22 flights in 3 months. Which is pretty crazy, right? It's pretty, when you say it, like, I've done 20. I hit the big 2-0 today, I guess. And really, if you go back, I mean, I flew back from Portland when I drove Poonmaster Flex out there. That was in November. I flew out there again in December. So, you know, that's 22, 23. So I'll have, like, 25 flights since November. So, you know, in 4 months, 25 flights. I mean, that's a lot, right? That's like being a band on tour or some shit. Anyway, so am I aware? I mean, I guess, you know, I've become more aware in the past few years of the terrible fear some people have of flying. And I do get it, like, it's not comfortable to begin with. If you had any sort of claustrophobia or anything like that, it would be horrible. If you don't really like people, like, you gotta be a people person to enjoy it on any level, because it's just like, to get on a plane and you just kind of fucking sit there. If you're very, like, observant of people and the way that people don't behave correctly bothers you, if you're like me, you're fucked. Like, there's no fucking way this is going to work out for you. But also, you know, it's like the speed, the motion isn't fun. Everything about it, you know, just doesn't seem... I mean, you get on there and they have you put on this fucking seatbelt that you're like, this is not going to do a damn thing. Like, has this seatbelt ever done a damn thing for anybody? I don't know. I'm not totally convinced. And you know why? Like, someone will bring a small child or a baby on there, and they're just sitting on their lap. And you're like, so a baby doesn't need a seatbelt, but an adult does? That makes a lot of sense. These must be really super effective, then. Ugh. But yeah, I guess I feel like I'm more likely to get killed by a berserk hobo or something, or like by drinking or not exercising, or like these seem to be the things that kill. I know I talked about Chuck a lot because that's been the significant experience, but he wrote this thing for GQ one time. It was actually, I think, kind of a precursor to like Marie Kondo and some of these other things, and it was about... you know, it's written in dramatic fashion, but he's like, every 3 or 4 years I decide to kill myself. And he's like, so, you know, I take these three steps, and he's like, I cull everything, so I basically, like, get rid of all the shit I don't need, all the papers and whatever, and, you know, do all the chores, and then I clean. I clean like crazy, like I obsessively clean, so that my place is perfectly neat. And then connect with people. So, you know, connect with people that you've lost touch with, or that, you know, you fought with, or whatever. And his whole thing is kind of like, you know, it's not the big thing that kills you. It's not the plane crash that kills you. Most people will tell you what kills you is, like, the slow accumulation of these papers and, you know, the slow buildup of things to do around the house and all that stuff. Like, that's what ends up killing you. By which I think he means crushing your spirit. And, like, taking care of all that stuff, sort of taking the time out of life to do that instead of doing your normal life stuff, I think is a way to combat that. And I totally agree with that philosophy. I think that's true. I think, like, for me, it's definitely the slow accumulation of bullshit. And I don't just mean objects, but I mean, like, little tasks and things and whatever. You know, like, I get the tax forms for our library, right? And I can tell, and I get, like, frustrated with it every year, because no one else wants to do it. So I'm like, I'll do it, but if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it my way. And my way is, I order enough shit to fulfill the need from last year, and no reorders. And so, like, this year we ran out of a bunch of stuff, and I was like, I'm not reordering it. And, like, people have asked me, like, a dozen times, like, when are we getting more? And I'm like, I've told everyone a dozen times and a dozen ways that there will be no reorders. And people don't like that, you know what I mean? They're like, but people need these forms. And I'm like, yeah, I've put out this other, I made a form that has the phone number and also the, like, walk-in help centers and all this stuff. You can call and have the forms delivered to your house directly. It takes 10 days. So it's like, I'm giving everyone as much possible means of success as I can, right? But at some point, it's like, ugh, enough. And the reason that I do it that way is because the last probably 3 years, I mean, fewer and fewer people are filing paper forms. And the last few years, I've recycled a huge amount of shit. Like, a crazy amount of stuff I've recycled, you know, once tax season is over. And so this is, like, super wasteful. Because, you know, they print based on how much is ordered. And also, they're shipping it, like, across the country to where I can get it and then put it out for people. And then I'm just putting it in a recycle where another giant diesel truck comes and picks it up. You know what I mean? It's, like, incredibly wasteful. And I'm trying to, the other thing is I'm trying to sort of wean people off of, like, using the library as their tax form outlet. The reason being, like, we're kind of the last man standing, and there's a lot of things we do because we're the last place that does it. But I have come to think of that as a terrible way to make decisions about what we should do. Because you'll notice that, like, it has nothing to do with, like, our mission or nothing to do with, like, our goals or anything like that. It's just, like, why are we doing this? Well, because we're the only ones who are doing it now. You know, like, we're the only place that has a typewriter. We're the only place that has a fax machine. You know what I mean? All this stuff. And it's like, I mean, I get it. Like, we don't want to leave people just in the lurch and whatever, and that's not a good feeling. But on the other hand, maybe we should be looking at things and saying, like, is this something that we should be doing? Like, does this help us complete our mission? Does this help us serve the public in a way? And is it something that we are well suited to do? And, like, tax forms, I would say, no, it is not. Because the thing is, if you have a bunch of tax forms there, everyone thinks that you're the tax expert, that you're the tax man. And they're just sort of like, which forms do I need? And when are you getting in this crazy form for small business loans or something? And you're like, never. You know what I mean? And it's like, they just come to have this expectation of you that is not realistic. There is a car turning into a driveway, and it's going on a 65 mile an hour road for like a quarter mile at 10 miles an hour. That was nuts. Anyway, it causes a lot more problems than it solves. But you know, this is the thing. Here's the lesson. So what I'm saying is, like, that's because I'm totally burned out on it and shouldn't do it anymore. Like, I should not be the one doing it, because I've done it for, I mean, I've probably done it for like 12 years. So it's like, and everyone's like, well, it's easier if you just do it, and so on and so forth. And I'm like, yeah, easier for everyone but me. Everyone else, yeah, of course it's easier for you. So anyway, I think, but that's my pitch to get rid of it for next year, is to be like, look, I've done it for like 12 years. I think it's fair to say I'm completely burned out on it. I wanted to stop doing it altogether a couple years ago. And here's why, is I foresaw, this wasn't like a great act of prognostication. This was like, well, we've done this sort of thing many times, and I suspect this will go the same. I have every reason to believe this will end the same way the others have ended. Which is to say, I have a feeling, oh, there's like a half-track weird tractor going on here. That's cool. I have reason to suspect that if we hang on to these tax forms, no one else is going to have them. Then we'll be in the only place that has them, and then we're stuck. And that turned out to be totally true. Like, you can't get them at the... You used to be able to get them at the post office, and the post office stopped doing it. And I was like, ugh, see, we shouldn't have quit before the post office. Or, like, we were doing notary service for a long time. And notary service was something, again, that it was like, how does this fit with our mission exactly? Like, what is the goal here? You know, and I can't tell you, because I was doing it before marijuana was just, like, generally legal. Basically, all I did was marijuana licenses. Like, you had to get them notarized, because it was just, like, they have to add this pain-in-the-ass step. I even went to, like, I'll call it a party, where a doctor was there, and this doctor was, you know, had to fill out some letter for anyone, you know, and so they basically had to say, like, I have chronic pain, and the doctor was like, cool, and filling out this letter. This doctor was actually pretty nice, and she was, like, actually asking them about their injuries and stuff. I mean, it was not like, well, your injury has to seem satisfactory for me to fill out this form for you. It was more like, I'm kind of interested in, like, what happened, and she was giving them a little bit of medical advice, which I thought was helpful. And you could tell, though, that some of the people, like, a guy was like, there was a guy who was probably, like, 20, and he's like, I fell off a BMX bike one time and hurt my back. And she was, like, asking him more questions, and he was kind of like, you know, like, because obviously he was just thinking, I haven't really been injured terribly in my life, and I'm young, so I gotta make something up. I mean, I'm pretty sure I have chronic pain and need marijuana. But anyway, that's, and so I was at this party as well, because, you know, you have to notarize the thing. So basically, this guy organized this little party where he had this doctor come. She tells everyone, you know, gives them their letter. I notarize their shit, and then they're, like, all set. They just have to turn in their paperwork. So they kind of all did the paperwork together. Great idea for a party, if you live in a state where that's a thing. And, you know, I think they all like, kicked in for the doctor. Like, they all kick in $10 or something like that. So then, you know, she makes, like, $150 in an hour. I mean, so that's a pretty sweet deal. And they were going to pay me, too, but I didn't care. And also, I was like, you know, I think the maximum I can charge you is $2 each. So, I mean, I would make $30, which is nothing to sneeze at, but I don't know. I just didn't care. I was like, this is not a hard job. And I counted it as work time. I was like, well, I'm supposed to notarize shit, right? And I'm reaching out to the community. But anyway, so we were notarizing, and the thing we got stuck in was like, well, we're the last place you can really do this. Like, the bank will do it. But even then, the bank usually only does it if it's like something they're relating to directly. But, you know, then you have people coming in to notarize stuff that you're like, you should be talking to a lawyer, not me. You know what I mean? Like, there was someone who was coming in over and over with all this crazy adoption paperwork. They were like adopting a baby from China or something. And you're just like, look, is the notary, you know, and they're like, well, which one of us is the, you know, proponent and which one of us is the surrogate or whatever? And you're like, I mean, I don't know. Like, my job is literally to look at your ID, look at the names on this thing, say, this is the same person who, you know, the person who's here. And then they get mad at you too because you're like, I need your ID. And they're like, I don't have it. And you're like, I mean, well, that makes what we're doing pointless. They're like, can't you do it anyway? And I'm like, I mean, I do think life is pointless, so I guess I could, but no. I mean, that wouldn't be allowed. So anyway, and we did eventually end our notary service, because it was just, like, out of hand. I mean, people would come in with, like, 25-page, super intricate legal documents, and you'd have to do a separate entry for each one, so it would take you, like, 45 minutes to do a notarization. And it's all walk-ins, you know, it's not like, people could make appointments, but no one's going to do that. I mean, when do you need it? Now. So anyway, I don't know how this relates to flying and the fact that I, you know, am headed towards an early grave. But I don't know, I've always thought about, like, plane crashing. I've always felt like, well, if I'm going to die on the plane, I definitely want to die on takeoff. And I think takeoff on the way back, provided I've been on vacation. Because that way, I just, you know, that way I'm, like, not stressed out or whatever, and I didn't just go through, like, a bunch of, like, a work week and then die. It's like, you know, if you were dying and you're on your way back from Vegas and you've been drunk for 3 days and you're like, eh, I mean, you know, I don't know if it was my time years-wise, but days-wise, if I had to pick a last few days, that was pretty fun. I'll say this too, like, flying, it's more nerve-wracking when you have things to live for. That sounds awful and depressing, but I remember being on a flight once and having no feeling of nervousness whatsoever and sort of thinking about it and just being like, I don't actually care if I live. Like, if I don't actually care if I arrive there or not. I mean, I wasn't suicidal. I wasn't like, I'm going to kill myself. But I just had this very odd sense of calm on this flight and was just like, you know, I'm not doing anything right now. I'm not, like, dating anybody. I don't, you know, really, whatever. My friends have their own lives. And I just don't, I'm not clinging to life that way. I'm not like, well, if I died, I wouldn't get to do this and that. I was kind of like, I don't know. It just seems fine for now. That was a weird flight. But it was a pretty good one. I mean, I remember because there was turbulence and stuff. And I was just like, I just don't care right now, and that was why.
I just felt very at peace, which I guess is good.
It sounds good when you say it, I was very at peace. It sounds awful when you say it, like, I didn't care if I lived. And would never care again. So I don't know, I think that also I've just got a sort of fatalistic view of the world in that I feel like, something will happen someday, and there's nothing you can do to predict it. But what I do know, what I can predict, is if I didn't go to this workshop, nothing would happen, right? Like, yeah, if you go out and you get on a plane, something bad could happen. Something bad could happen. Let me say it in a different way, emphasizing different words. Something bad could happen if you get on a plane. Nothing good will happen if you don't do anything. I mean, that's the truth. That's the honest truth. There was one other piece of listener mail. It was about, I was talking about a movie what's that Christopher Nolan movie? Interstellar. Interstellar. In front of the show, Ian was on a minor tweet tear about how that movie's not that great because it's not all brilliant. And also, there's not characters that anyone cares about. And I totally agree with what he's saying. Like, I don't think that movie is, like, brilliant. But I think it is brilliant. And I don't think it's brilliant because it's, like, a great plot and, like, a great idea and whatever. I think it's brilliant because that dude just makes super watchable movies. I mean, he makes movies that, even if the story isn't great, are very compelling to watch. And you are interested and kind of along for the ride. I mean, I remember sitting in Interstellar and thinking, like, this is kind of dumb, and I think I know where this is going, and I don't really care for that much, but I'm still interested. I'm still interested enough to see this through to the end. And so I think that's the thing, is it was interesting enough as a movie, even if the story wasn't, like, this great shakes or whatever. So I don't know. I think he's got I still do think that Christopher Nolan has a form of brilliance because, like, for example, Inception. I don't think that's, like, a mind-blowing movie. In as much as, like, it kind of just treats the idea of, like, how do we know we are or are not in a dream, right? And it's like, okay, that's kind of interesting. But, you know, it's like, it's the same question that's asked by The Matrix, right? How do we know we're not in a computer simulation? Like, how do we know that all of life isn't just a big video game that someone else is playing, right? And you're just an artificial intelligence that's been dropped into the game. And at any point, it's going to be like, Steve, it's dinner time, and, you know, Intergalactic Steve is going to rip that cartridge out of his Space Nintendo, and then it's all over. You know what I mean? Like, it's the same idea. But, you know, I think that what was smart about it wasn't, like, the idea of dreams and, like, what is a dream and what's reality. I think that what was smart about it is he made a movie where he sort of made you care what happened in a dream. And also, there were stakes inside the dream. And also, he combined a type of movie that never works, the dream sort of spacey movie, with a type of movie that always works, which is the heist movie. So, you know, basically it was a heist movie with this ethereal element to it, or this sort of other plane element to it. So I think that concept is really great. Like, I think it's well thought out to say, you know, I can't just make a movie that's about dreams, but what if I did it like this? And they totally did. And I just think it works. And I think Interstellar is kind of the same thing. I think they kind of tried to... Like, I think here's the weakness to me, is just too much shit going on. I don't know that I need it to be like the Earth is dying of climate change, and so we need to find another suitable planet, and we've got... For some reason, we're in like a big fucking hurry to do it now. Even though it's like... I mean, haven't we known that this was happening like forever? And also, space travel technology has come really super far, and robot technology has come really super far, but not like climate, you know, climate reversing technology or climate, you know, stabilizing technologies. That seemed a little far-fetched, right? But this is the thing, is like, you can go through, I think, any of his movies, or any movie, really. Pick any movie, and you can kind of go through and start poking holes in it. But I don't think those holes make it, like, not interesting to watch. I think it's, like, some movies just require you to accept a certain set of things as just being what they are. So, in other words, it's like, if you're going to ask all these questions about why didn't they do this or why didn't they do that with the technology, it's like, well, you're not going to enjoy this. And if you're not going to enjoy Interstellar, you definitely shouldn't watch it. As to the characters thing, I mean, yeah, I don't think there weren't like these great memorable characters, right? There's not a Peter Venkman of Interstellar. But I do think that, like, it did say something about people, which is basically like So my recollection of this movie is they sent out like these three astronauts to check out these three different planets. And they were only supposed to light up their beacon if they ended up on a planet that was inhabitable. And three of them go out and three beacons light up. And they visit two, and two of the people had lit their beacons even though there was like no chance of inhabiting the planets they ended up on. The Matt Damon and the first person who was just a dead body, basically. So, you know, it was, I think it was saying something about how, like, you know, they didn't want to die alone, or people are selfish, or whatever, right? Being that far from everybody and everything. I mean, there's a lot there that I think is not super explicitly said, but is also, I think it's said in some ways in the movie. But anyway, so I think that there's not like great characters, and I think that like a lot of his movies are like that. Inception, like who's the great character? There's not really a great character in that movie, right? There's Leonardo DiCaprio, who's like the master. There's Ellen Page, who's like the learner. There's Tom Hardy, who's like the guy running around with guns. There's Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who's kind of like, if Tom Hardy's the heavy, he's the light heavy, I guess. You know, it's like you kind of have these people, but they're not, there's nothing about them. If I had to write like fan fiction about them, I wouldn't really know where to go with it, right? Because there's not a lot to them. But I think that like sometimes a movie can be good even if it's not, it doesn't have everything, you know. I think that like I mean, somebody out there enjoys these Transformers movies. Those do not have characters in them at all. They don't have like anything interesting going on. They don't have I mean, if we're going to talk about Interstellar not being a brilliant story, I mean, give me a break, right? Transformers not. Robots that turn into cars who are from the moon or something. It's like, obviously that's a dumb idea. But, you know, if you kind of are just like, I mean, I'm here to watch a robot car movie. And I think this is the problem with Christopher Nolan that I'm going to put out there. Now, I don't really know. If he's running around telling the world he's brilliant, then I'm wrong here, right? But I think this is like one of those things where there's a portion of the world running around saying how brilliant Christopher Nolan is, and that pisses some people off because they're like, he's not that brilliant. Can't you see he's just kind of doing the same shit, and like all the things he's doing have been done before and done better and so on and so forth. And so I think that like, there's a weird thing that happens when someone gets elevated to this status of, you know, being a great director or a great writer or something, which is like, as soon as they're elevated to that status, there has to be a backlash. There has to be a counter argument. There has to be a group of people who are like, no, you fools, don't you see? I mean, this is kind of like, you know, with writing stuff, right? Like, a new writer will come along and people will get excited about them. But you kind of see, like, it's hard to impress me with, like, a Gone Girl. Because I'm like, I mean, the unlikable female character is not something you see that often, but I don't think this is the best version of it. You know, the sort of, is this person crazy or diabolical and what's the difference? I mean, all these things, right? You read all this stuff and you're just like, I mean, this is kind of the same shit that so-and-so did and such did. But, you know that because you're really into the thing. But other people don't know that because they're not really into film. And I think the thing about movies is they're so accessible. I mean, anyone can sit and watch a movie and probably understand it on some level. So like, you've got a much wider range of people who will talk about it and debate about movies than you will about books, even. Or like, I mean, how much of a debate are you going to have with somebody about like art, like paintings in a museum? Probably not much, right? I mean, probably you're not going to get a lot of traction there, I would think. So I think that's the thing, is that, you know, it's entertainment for the masses, and then there are also the critics who look at the same thing, and everyone's looking at the same thing, but obviously coming at it in a different way. But so I kind of think that, like, you know, there's this thing where nobody likes when, you know, a director or somebody like that calls himself brilliant, or is making these things that people are calling brilliant, that aren't brilliant. And, but I think that's really, like, who is that? Roland Barthes or whatever, who said that the author's dead. And I think that's totally the case with something like Christopher Nolan. I mean, he makes his things, he turns them out into the world, and then people call it brilliant. You know what I mean? People are like, well, this is... Dark Knight is like a superhero movie, a comic book movie. Everyone was like, he showed that a comic book movie can be like a real movie. And I was like, not really. I mean, if you watch some of these other comic book movies, they definitely do the same things. And, like, I don't think he was doing anything totally brand new and totally different. And I also don't think that, I mean, I think there's a lot to be said for some of the other movies that have, you know, that came before it and kind of paved the way. You know, without Spider-Man 2, I don't think you get a Dark Knight. Let me put it like that. Like, without Sam Raimi taking on a Spider-Man movie. And if you watch, like, Spider-Man 2, it's a superhero movie, but it's got, like, a flavor to it because Sam Raimi was doing it, right? It's not, like, just sort of a generic... I mean, this is the kind of the complaint I have about most of the superhero movies these days, is they're kind of samey in as much as, like, the overall plot is kind of the same and the overall character set is kind of the same. Like, everything's not the same, but kind of the same. Even, like, Thor Ragnarok. Like, I enjoyed watching Thor Ragnarok. But, you know, I would probably get all pissy if someone was like, this is a brilliant movie. Because I'd be like, I mean, it was fun. It had some good stuff to it. But ultimately, how different was it from, you know, Thor Part 2? I mean, it's different because it's like, it's got some Jeff Goldblum shit in it. And it's got probably more humor in it than the others. But it's not like worlds apart. Separate Ways, Worlds Apart by Journey. It's, you know, it's got a different tone, but it's not a completely new idea in cinema, right? So, and, you know, you can hear the tone of my voice that I get all dismissive of shit like that. And that's the thing, is I think that whatever it is you're into, you get mad when someone who is called brilliant, who you're like, I don't think they're that brilliant. But the author's dead, you put it out in the world, and then people decide that. And if you're Christopher Nolan, I don't think it's your job to go and disavow people of the notion that you're brilliant. I mean, if people are complimenting your work and saying they really liked your movie and they're calling you brilliant, I don't know that it's somebody's job to go out there and be like, no, no, I am not brilliant, okay? I'm just a man. Because it's like, why bother? Everyone else is going to do that for you anyway. Don't worry about it.
I never saw Dunkirk. I don't know. I'm not real into war movies these days.
I never was, and, like, even now. War movies always have, like, the good ones always have a couple great scenes. And then, like, a super huge problematic portion. Okay, I'll give you an example of, like, a Christopher Nolan for me. It was The Hurt Locker. And it was, like, everyone called that movie brilliant. And I thought it had some great scenes in it and overall worked. But, like, the last third, it totally falls apart. You could tell that was a movie that Kathryn Bigelow was like, I do not know how to end this movie. Because it was like, all right, so they have this weird masculine moment where they're, like, fist fighting each other. Then Jeremy Renner, like, escapes outside the military base and is, like, going to find the parents of this, what he thinks is this dead kid, and like all this weird shit is going on that doesn't really make sense. And then ultimately we end up, you know, back in the United States, and then it's like, it takes us a long time to get the message, which I think we already would have understood, which is like, this guy doesn't really fit anymore. Everyone talks about, you know, he's trying to pick out cereal in the cereal aisle, right? And it's like, he doesn't really fit into regular society anymore because he's had this experience. And I was like, that's totally true. And I think expressed in that scene, but that wasn't like something new to me. I mean, reading like war fiction and stuff like that, I don't think the idea of the veteran coming back to the regular world and not really, the regular world doesn't work anymore for them, like that is not a new concept. And weirdly, like, I thought it was better expressed when he's talking to his wife and he's telling her about, you know, this bomb that blew up and like, here's what happened and blah, blah, blah. And she's like completely uninterested in it. Not like aggressively like, oh, your stories are boring. But she's like trying to cook dinner and she's like, hey, will you cut these for me? You know, while he's telling this story. And it's obvious there's a disconnect there of like, she doesn't understand like this is the only thing he cares about. And also, of course, it's the only thing he cares about because it's fucking crazy what happened. But, you know, so that's a movie that I thought was really super good. But I think it was nominated for like Best Picture that year. And I was like, I mean, if I could edit this by 2/3, I would love to see it be Best Picture. You know what I mean? I think that there was some compelling watchable shit in there. But then there was a lot of weird stuff that seemed like it was from another movie, or like it seemed like a script that had come together 5 different times and there were just some remnants there that they accidentally put in the movie. Or like, you know what it felt like? Reading stories for this workshop, I've seen this happen. You know, someone will write a draft of a story, then they'll redraft and redraft. But then some remnant of something gets left in there because basically they just couldn't bear to get rid of it. They just liked it too much and couldn't get rid of this one element, right? And so it's in there still. But then when you're seeing it as a reader for the first time and you see this story, it's got this element in it that totally stands out and does not fit the rest of the story at all. Like, it doesn't work and it's very confusing, and a lot of times like a room full of people will get extremely caught up in that one thing. They'll become very fixated on it because it's just so inexplicable and doesn't make sense. But they want to make sense of it because everything else made sense. That's kind of what those scenes felt like in The Hurt Locker to me. Was like something that was from a different movie that was essentially a different idea, but stayed in because they just liked it a lot and didn't want to get rid of it. You know, which I understand that instinct, but it's like, that's how it felt. Disjointed and stuff like that.
So, I mean, I guess I would argue, you know, over the
slowest method possible here, that Interstellar is like a really watchable movie. I don't think it's like doing anything brand new. But I think there's still, to me, there's a brilliance in doing something very simple and accomplishing it competently, and in a way that's compelling. I mean, that shit's compelling to watch. Also, my argument, against there's no characters in the movie was, the robots are the best characters in the movie. Obviously. Fascinating. They do these little, you know, body morphs. They do some transforming. Maybe this was Christopher Nolan's Transformers.
But that's how I always feel. Always like,
who's my favorite character in Short Circuit? I mean, duh, Johnny Five, right? Who's the best character in WALL-E? Duh, WALL-E. Who's the best character in Star Wars Rogue One? Duh, the robot. Even though I didn't love that. I was like, oh, really? Another sassy robot. Okay, so they did in Star Wars. They did the thing where they, like, go to this planet and they're like, so all these soldiers are clones? And then they're like, okay, well, now they're not clones anymore. And you're just like, all right. I mean, that does not really matter to me, I guess. Maybe it made more sense if they were clones, because it's like, well, they probably don't even have an entire brain. So that's why you can just, like, put them in PVC pipe armor and march them around, and they're just like, well, whatever. But I want to see the Star Wars where they explain, the origin of, like, what was the intelligence that these robots are based on? Like, I want to, they're like meeting this, like, sassy asshole guy. Like, I'm picturing, like, a, you know, who's, like, the, Billy Eichner of the Star Wars universe, that someone was like Billy Eichner, but like a less agitated, but, you know, kind of like cutting and funny, but also mean, but, you know, less out there, I guess. Who's the Billy Eichner of the Star Wars universe upon which all these droids, they're like, let's base the personality on this. And it's like, really? So all these robots are going to be, like, sniping at each other and, like, blaming each other for getting them into trouble and stuff like that? And it's like, yeah. And it's like, why are we programming robots that have a snappy comeback when they do something they're not supposed to do? Like, maybe we should just program them to do what the fuck they're supposed to do. Also, I don't understand at, like, what point in the Star Wars universe, at what point is a droid not like a servant? I mean, it seems weird to me that the droids are like enslaved. They seem to have independent thought. They seem to be self-aware. I feel like this is the thing, right? You get to the singularity and then it's like, well, listen, we can't just, can we force robots to drive us around all the time? I mean, if it was self-aware, if it was like, hi, I'm Timmy. I'm your car today. Here are my views and opinions on the world. And I'd be like, wow, this is weird. All right. I guess we could talk about that. I don't know. I mostly just wanted a ride. But yeah, it's like, we won't be able to do that, right? But Star Wars seems to have sort of just decided that that's fine. And, you know, you can, like, enslave a robot. You can torture it by putting it upside down and putting a hot metal plate on its feet that seems to hurt it for some reason. You know, R2-D2 seems to experience physical pain. Like, he screams when stuff hurts him, you know, when he gets, like, blasted or whatever. Which I always thought was weird, too. I was like, why would you program... It's like in Star Trek. Okay, in Star Trek, Data is an android, right? But he seems to be kind of allowed to do whatever he wants. Or, like, Aliens. This has a similar robot problem. They're androids like Bishop. I mean, Bishop seems to be fully self-aware and self-guiding and stuff like that. But also seems to be, like, an evil plot by the company somehow. And it's like, I mean, could you do that? How could you do that? Like, the one thing I'll give to the Star Wars universe, they had the sense to make them not look like people. Also, their droids, like, okay, the new droid in Rogue One, too, it also has the problem of lots of Star Wars, or lots of robots in fiction, which is, why did we make this robot, like, 100 times stronger than a man? Yet, if you go back to Episode 1 and they have, like, the droid armies, those droids don't seem particularly strong. They're not very robust. You can, like, hit them with a stick and they break apart. So it's like, well, why would you bother creating a robot army that's so weak? And yet you'd have this sort of robot... I don't know what that guy's job was. I assume he must have been some kind of battle bot. But who knows? But then he's, like, 10 times stronger than a man. And you're like, you know, maybe just make a robot, like, about the equivalent strength of a man. I mean, that seems doable. Like, then we could quell a crazy robot, but also they'd still be useful. I mean, here's the thing. Like, how strong does a robot have to be? You know, how many groceries are you buying? And couldn't the robot just take, like, 20 trips because it's a robot? So who cares? It's like, ugh, the robot doesn't want to make 20 trips to the car. It's like, the robot's not going to know. The robot does not care. It does a task until it's finished, right? So you might as well just make the robot have
the strength of, like, a very enfeebled old lady. And then you don't have to worry about dying.
I don't know. This is my two cents.